this episode of GeoTalk, we discover a new file format for storing millions of geocaches in your GPS. We uncover 101 devil cache designs, and we learn how GNSS is being used to track drop bears. All this and more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to episode 95 of GeoTalk for February 2013. Now, first of all, apologies. This is actually the first time I've missed a month in not getting GeoTalk out. We've been running this now since, I think, November 2006. And unfortunately, I missed out on getting it out in time for January. A little bit more about that at the end of the podcast. I'll explain why. But first of all, let's get into some geocaching news. First of all, there's a story that one of my colleagues at ABC Science ran about combining GNSS signals in GPS devices. And I'll mention a little bit in the next item about one particular GPS receiver that is already doing that. But a group here in Australia are actually looking at combining various different systems, and in this particular case, combining the European Galileo system with the US GPS system. And they're looking at a way of developing a chip that will not only combine those two, but also the Chinese Beidou and also the Russian GLONASS systems, so that we can have an all-in-one device, all in on the one chip. So you can check that out. That's on the ABC Science website. Also features in Star Stuff, and I'll give you a link for that as well, where you can listen to one of the researchers about that work they're doing on combining GNSS signals. Now, one of those units that is already combining GNSS signals, that is from the GLONASS Russian system and the US GPS system, is the Oregon 600 series. And one of the interesting things about this series, according to a GPS track log, is that they've now released a new format at Garmin called a GGZ file format, which allows the unit to be able to store 4 million geocaches. Now, according to Groundspeak's latest stats, I think they're sitting at about 1.985 million geocaches. Geocaching Australia would be at several tens of thousands of geocaches, if you include trig points, probably a few more. And also you've got Open Caching, you've also got opencaching.com and a number of other different places. But certainly that would more than easily cover the whole world of geocaches. So check that out. I'll give you a link in the show notes at the GPS track log all about the Garmin 600 series, along with the way in which it combines the GLONASS and GPS signals and a few other really interesting features. It's a really schmick-looking device. Check it out, the Oregon 600 series. Now, while I was perusing It's Not About the Numbers blog, I came across a very interesting listing about a new book that's come out from the Mad Geocacher bloggers. Now, if you're not aware of the Mad Cacher bloggers, they recently purchased Navicaching, and to help fund their expansion of Navicache.com, they've actually put out a book called 101 Devil Caches, Your Guide to Creating Unique or Hard-to-Find Geocaches. It's the result of the duo, that is Joseph Martin III and Kurt Milligan, who have been trying to tackle some particularly difficult hides, and they've been looking at a way in which to revamp the outdated listing service, Navicache.com. So you can check that out. You can already buy it from their website through Amazon, but you can head over to madcacher.com, click on the link for 101 Devil Cacher's Mad Cacher book. It'll be out on Kindle version very soon. Time now to head across the ditch to New Zealand and find out how Alan, Radio Nut 50 and Butterfly Lady went during their travels over Christmas here in Australia.
Hi there to all the caches from Radio Nut 50 in Hamilton, New Zealand, with some caching stories and some local news. Well, Butterfly Lady and I are home again after a really great holiday in Australia. We spent some days in Adelaide, some in Melbourne and nearby Geelong. and we did lots of touring and lots of caching. Before we left home, though, we contacted SA Parrothead as one of the more longer-term caches in Adelaide and asked if they'd be interested in publishing an event on one of the days that we were in town to give us an opportunity to meet some locals. The day nominated by Andrew, coincidentally, was my birthday. And surprisingly for me, a cake was produced, and the logbook was a birthday card, which I now treasure as a memento of a great gathering. After the event, we had a special treat with an escorted caching run around the Barossa with the Parrothead team. As an extra bonus, though, a couple of days before that, another popular cacher, Honeysucker, had published a rather special event called For Christmas Orphans. It was on Christmas afternoon. Since we were in town by ourselves, we had another opportunity to meet some more Adelaide caches. Now, over these two events, we met many fun caches, some of whom are now becoming a bit like old friends, because we've run across each other several times at different mega events and elsewhere. One interesting member of this addicted peoples in this fun hobby that we met, he caches under the name of Sushi Lord, and he's working on a special personal caching achievement that really impressed me, continuous days finding a cache. We heard that he's currently got a total of well over 1,000 days of finding at least one cache every day. I didn't write down the actual total, sorry, but wow, what a heck of an achievement. So thinking about some of the more memorable caches during our holiday, there were a couple of historic gold mining area caches on our drive with the Parrotheads. One was called Barossa Gold and another called On Golden Pond. We really enjoyed being brought to this historic area, and they take you down and show you lots of that area. We did a couple of Warrego caches during our travels, including one in central Adelaide called Beware Drop Bears. And we really enjoyed finding one of these elusive creatures that we Kiwis have been warned about so many times when we visited that country. On moving to Victoria, we enjoyed caching by tram. As a railway nut, that's a lot of fun for me, hopping on and hopping off at different points. Then we headed to Geelong, and we visited Altona on the way. We did really enjoy in that area some specially constructed hides by Tacklehead. Now, well done. These are all mechanical achievements, and they're marvellous and worth seeking out if you're in that area. There's also some really good history lessons from caches around there. While heading for the airport on our last day, another area we would never have found without geocaching was at the coast near Avalon. There's a hide listed as the end of civilization. It's a pretty good description for this area, although it's populated, it's very remote and really magical. Going back while we were in Adelaide, we had a go at a few of the hides in a special power trail called Wandering Heroes that honours well-known caches, but it's got individually contributed hides into this power trail by many different people. We'd heard of this one before we went over there, and while the time we had didn't allow completing too many of them, we probably did about a third of the trail, this one did take us north of the city to a new area for our holidaying, and that was enjoyable in itself too. Now, I've mentioned before on GeoTalk that one of the fun aspects of geocaching Linda and I enjoy together is our racing travel bugs. We've got a pair of toy zebras called Zara and Zeke, and they've been placed together in caches overseas before. They've got clear labels on them asking for them to be brought back to a cache near a home in Hamilton, New Zealand as a race. Now, on two occasions, they've started out together, but my zebra Zeke has gone missing completely both times. Well, this time they started out afresh in Adelaide, and again Linda's Zara headed out the first in quick time. But Zeke languished away, and then, horrors, at the first cache that Zara was dropped, it got destroyed by a tree-felling operation, and she's reported gone. Oh dear, how sad. Now Zeke stayed hiding in the cache that we left the pair for a while, got picked up and dropped off, so he's moving. But alas, the cache he's ended up in only has about two or three visitors a year, a lonely dunes cache called Angry Birds in the Coorong National Park south of Adelaide. So may not really be home for a little while to collect his winning laurels. The next New Zealand mega events now into planning stages. This is a special opportunity to caches from New Zealand who live in the northern parts of our country, who maybe found travelling to Dunedin last year a little bit daunting. In fact, anyone who's not joined one of these stimulating gatherings where you get the chance to rub shoulders with hundreds of people with similar outlook on life to yourself should really consider taking up this opportunity. There's a small committee working on this mega, and it's been timed for the 26th to 28th of October, that's Labour weekend, a long weekend here, in 2013. It's based in the North Harbour Stadium, which is in Albany, just north of Auckland. At this stage, they really are seeking expressions of interest to gauge the likely numbers. So do have a look at their webpage. We'll post the URL on the show notes. Or just Google New Zealand Mega Event and you'll find it. So for a quick roundup of New Zealand events coming up soon. In the North Island, we've got one called The Real Deal. It's on the 2nd of February in Lyle Bay, Wellington. And the group there will be viewing a special geocaching movie at a boutique cinema. That sounds like fun. On the same day, there's an event with a curious name of An Event With No Particular Reason. And that's in Central Auckland, listed by the organising committee of the 2013 New Zealand Mega. So it will be a great opportunity to ask some questions. Then there's the traditional Waitangi Day barbecue and campout in the Auckland area, organised every year, and again this year by Kiwi Leon and Greenblatt. It's on the 9th of February, and at this time it's at Whātipu site. And Tuffy has organised a GSAK or GSAC event in Mount Albert, Auckland, on the 23rd of February. In the South Island, Kiwi Nomad is celebrating Waitangi Day with a family picnic event, on the 9th of February, of course, and that's in Ashburton. And Kiwi Explorer is listing a Valentine's Day event in Rabbit Island, Nelson, on the 16th of February. Geopop NZ has listed the first ever event in Blenheim on the 1st of March. Now, if you ever get a chance to call into one of these events, go for it. They're always fun and a great opportunity to have a chat over our hobby. Okay, well, it's back to you, Darren.
Well, thanks for that update, guys. And it sounds like you had a lot of fun, and it's a pity we didn't cross paths, but I'm sure the Australian geocaching community took care of you just as the Kiwis have whenever I've gone over there as well. Well, before we get into the interview for this episode, the trivia question for episode 95 is how many Terrain 5 geocaches are there in each state and region of Australia and New Zealand? So that's how many Terrain 5 geocaches there are in Australia and New Zealand. The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, every now and again, we dive into the scientific journals, and this week, a colleague of mine pointed out an article in the Australian Geographer from the December 2012 edition, and the author of that article, Volker Jensen, has joined us on the podcast. Welcome to the podcast.
G'day, how are you?
I'm good. Now, the title of your paper, Indirect Tracking of Drop Bears Using GNSS Technology. We mentioned to a lot of people who are thinking of coming to Australia, you know, highlighting the different snakes and spiders and stingers and all that sort of thing to watch out for. But drop bears, tell us a little bit about what they are.
Well, the drop bear is basically known as the evil twin of the koala because they're very similar looking. But the koala is our cute icon that we have in Australia, and the drop bear is kind of the evil twin because it is also a marsupial, but it can attack, and so it's carnivorous. The problem that bushwalkers often face is that if they bushwalk in drop bear territory, that they might get attacked by a drop bear.
So what are the signs that indicate the difference between a koala and a drop bear? Is there anything that you can tell about them as you're walking through the bush, or is it usually too late?
It's possibly too late, because they look very much like a koala. However, the big difference is that the drop bears actually have big canine teeth, and they are used for as biting tools for attacks on prey and so forth. And the koala doesn't have any teeth at all. The koala just munches on eucalypt leaves. Mm-hmm. So they live in the same habitat, and that's why it's very hard to take to tell them apart. But the drop bear actually just quietly waits on top of the tree for hours until prey is in striking range, and then basically drops several meters out of the tree onto the unsuspecting victim, and latches onto the victim's neck to bite and kill the prey. And usually, I mean, there's studies that have looked at this in detail and found that the drop bear feasts on medium to large types of mammal. So sometimes, or quite often actually, the prey is larger than the drop bear itself. And that's when humans get into trouble as well, because humans are not necessarily targeted specifically by the drop bear. But if you are in the unfortunate position of just walking past and you've got a hungry drop bear sitting in the tree, then you might get attacked.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit like, I suppose, swimmers getting into the surf and being attacked by sharks. That's the humans aren't necessarily the food of the sharks, but they just happen to be in the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, they're notoriously shy. They're hard to find, and obviously they are quite dangerous. Have there been previous studies looking into how to sort of map the distribution of them and the behaviour of them?
Well, there have been quite a few studies on drop bears. And if you look through the paper a little bit, you find this a map, because the actual distribution of drop bears is mapped by the National Drop Bear Index. So you find most of the drop bears along the east coast of Australia, but they do live further inland as well, in areas that support woodland. So my study basically looked at, well, how can we map the distribution of drop bears a bit more accurately, mm-hmm. because drop bears are rare and pose a threat to unsuspecting bushwalkers. So we obviously want to limit the effect, the negative effect on the human population, but also we want to make sure that the drop bear population survives. Mm-hmm. Especially now in an era where the human population expands more and more into a natural habitat of drop bears.
So instead of fitting the GNSS or the GPS receivers, as we would more commonly know them as, to the bears themselves, you actually attach them to volunteers who walked in the bush. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I in this paper I present an indirect method to track these drop bears, and normally if you use GNSS tracking or GPS tracking. GNSS is just the term to encompass not only the GPS system, but systems from other countries as well, like the Russian GLONASS system, for example. Yeah. Normally, when you do GNSS tracking, you attach the sensor to the animal and then basically collect data to find the trajectories of these animals and therefore map the population. But with drop bears, that's very difficult because they live in trees, and therefore you get a lot of data outages due to the dense tree canopy. And also the drop bear has got the habit of rubbing its body against tree branches and so forth. And then, of course, you get a lot of sensors that break and are damaged during attacks on prey. Right. So I was looking for an alternative method to map the distribution of drop bears, and this is this indirect method, which basically tracks the prey rather than the predator. And so by mapping the location and timing of drop bear attacks, you can then map the population, because drop bears are very territorial, so they don't stray far from a small number of trees in close proximity, which they use as hunting ground. Mm.
Now, you've come up with some interesting findings. One of the interesting things I noticed, and this has been backed up by previous research, is that local or Australian Australians are less likely to be attacked by drop bears than visiting tourists or people from overseas. Can you explain briefly why that is the case?
The thing is that, as you said, that there have been several studies that looked at the behaviour of drop bears, and particularly also the protection from drop bear attacks. So, for example, some of the methods that were investigated by various studies as wearing forks in your hair, spreading Vegemite or toothpaste behind your ears or under your armpits, urinating on yourself, and avoiding talking in a foreign language or even in an accent other than Australian, mm-hmm. because these studies have shown that that Australians are not as prone to attacks as tourists. And this is, for example, due to Australians being very fond of Vegemite usually. They eat it once a day at least from when they were little. And a study, for example, has found that the byproducts of the interaction between the chemicals that you find in Vegemite and those that you find in human sweat, they actually repel drop bears. And so Australians have this natural protection, if you so will, because they exude these chemicals through their skin permanently. But on the other hand, visitors, they don't have that natural protection, so they should be cautious and use, for example, Vegemite to spread behind and towards the top of the ear, mm-hmm. Because that's an area prone to sweating and it's close to the top of the head. So that has proven to be quite a good method to repel drop bears. Mm-hmm. The best protection that was found was to simply wear a motorcycle helmet when bushwalking. Obviously, if you do that in the tropics, it might not be very practical because it's rather hot. So that's where these other methods come into play as well. But it's mainly to be prepared and beware, because basically bushwalkers, they walk through the territory of the bush, of the drop bear. So it's we just should be aware and not hunt them down, but rather protect them.
Okay. Now, I understand that you're looking to expand this research into other species. I see in the conclusions you talk about Bali dragons and British drop badgers. Has there been any interest from overseas into using these sorts of techniques to track these animals?
Well, not yet, but I'm hoping that now. I mean, it's just been published, the paper, so hopefully there will be a bit of interest now. Because the problem with this research that I had was limited funding, which is a big problem across the whole science community. And so I would like to extend the study also into different areas and so forth. Because as I've described in the paper, we've seen a few parallels to the Bundy bear as well, and it would be necessary to kind of extend this into different field seasons and also different field areas to then kind of come to better conclusions in terms of whether these parallels are actually true and can be proven.
Well, that's some sage words of advice. Thank you very much, Dr. Jensen, for bringing us up to date on the world of drop bears.
No worries. My pleasure. Cheers.
Time to have a look at some of the events that are occurring around Australia over February. On the 5th of February, there's the No Longer Haunted by Bingo, which is being held down near Hobart by Cheesy Pigs on the 5th of February. On the 6th of Feb is 1000 by Splatum down in Melbourne. On the 9th of February is the Rabble Axe and Crazy Nat Girl Engagement Party. That's also being held out in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. On the 10th of Feb, there's the Letsito Little Para Trail number 5 on the northern suburbs of Adelaide. And also on the 10th of Feb is the Northwest New South Wales and Southwest Queensland meet and greet. It's being held in Moree at Rocket Park. On the 17th of February, there's the 7th annual Illawarra Get Together being held by the Rats. And also on the 17th of February is the TB Dispersal Riverway. That's being held out near Townsville in far north Queensland. On the 23rd of February is the Forest Challenge number 7 out on the Sunshine Coast hinterland. On the 23rd of February, there's the 2012 Victorian Cache of the Year Awards being held out in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. And the 24th of February is the GeoTrek 2013. That's being held up in Dural in the northern suburbs of Sydney. And just popping over into March, on the 2nd of March, Caching by the Nepean over in over near Penrith by the Hoogs. And also on the 3rd of March, there's a number of events for Clean Up Australia Day. It's the first Sunday of March. And so check out the listings for that in your area. There might be a CETO event being held then. So that's all the events occurring around the country. If you want to highlight yours, don't forget to give us a call, 02 800 5436, or drop us an email at geotourpodcast@gmail.com. And talking about calls and emails that have come into the podcast, first I've got an email from a group of researchers who have been looking for people to contribute towards a geocaching survey, a motivation survey. They just write in to say, dear geocaching community, your support for our survey on geocaching motivations has been outstanding. We currently have about 600 respondents to our first survey. And we write not only to update you on the progress, but also to say thank you. A special mention to everyone who's helped promote the survey. The first survey will be available until the 8th of Feb, so you've got a couple of days left to get in if you haven't already filled in your response. And just a reminder that the results of that survey will be used to create a second survey, which will be available around the 1st of March. I'll give you a link in the show notes, but that's from Robert, Amerhosen, and Elizabeth from over in North America who are writing in for that one. But you can check out the geotalkpodcast.com website for a link to that particular survey. A couple of calls now to come in. Got a few coming in here. First one from Neukmeister down in Canberra with a tip regarding new geocaches.
G'day, Darren. It's Jeremy here from Canberra, also known as Neukmeister. Just wanted to relate to you a tale that underscores something you've been talking about on the podcast lately. Got an email this morning, and as I read it, my heart sank. Subject: hidden cache from seen at, redacted. Hey, mate, found your little pink lunchbox at minus 35 degrees, blah, 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 149 degrees, blah, 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 east. Added a little toy. Sounds like fun you guys get up to. Keeping in the spirit of the game, I placed it at 35 degrees, 27 minutes, 2 seconds, 149 degrees, 4 minutes, 27 seconds. At 3 a.m., at half past midnight last night. Hope you find it. Regards, Scene. And I thought, oh no. Went and checked it out. It's a puzzle cache of mine, which is why I didn't read out full coordinates of where he found it. And so I sent him a nice email saying, oh, hi, you know, welcome to geocaching. The cache you found is this cache. Here's the link to it. Here's a link to geocaching.com. Normally, you don't need them. And but thanks for letting me know where you put it. I'll go and pick it up. And anyway, later on that day, I get a email reply back from him, very apologetic, saying that he's sorry that he stuck me around. And then about 5 minutes later, I get a phone call. And he says, oh, listen, you know, I'm really sorry. I'll go and put it back where it was. And we had a short conversation. I found out that the cache hadn't been left, it was out in the open. Not sure how that happened, but he offered to go and pick it up because he wasn't happy that where he'd hidden it was going to be not found by anyone that day. It's a popular spot. And he took it home, and I went and picked it up on the way home from work. So that just sort of underscores what you're saying about leaving your contact details in your cache. I do it in every cache that I've got. It's got an email address and a mobile number. And it will help you one day to get your cache back, as it has helped me. Anyway, just a short tale for you to include in the podcast. Thanks, mate. Bye.
Well, thanks for that call, Jeremy. And now we go to another regular caller from up in the Hunter Valley, Marcelo, also known as Darth Trader.
G'day, Geo Talk. It's Darth Trader calling in. Just been out on a FDF hunt out in the Cessnock, Curry Curry, New South Wales region. There's a case got listed last week. It's called Whispers. It's GC443RR. It's a very interesting puzzle to look at. It's by a case called Cut Sprocket. And I'm quite impressed. It's a sound, it's an audio cache, and to my mind, to list a cache as an audio, you played the audio and it says, look for the cache here at south, 30 whatever, east whatever, but this wasn't the case. He had some quite interesting sound effects, like murmuring, like as if you were listening to ghost noises or haunted building noises, and that's what the cache was built around, hence the name Whispers. You analyse without giving it away, you actually find text in the wave format. I'm not going to tell you how to do it, but it's there. So quite surprised. I don't even know how he would have done that. So I scratched my head a bit and kept poking that one with a stick for about a week before I've come up with the coordinates. And I've come here after it's been listed for a week, and I found a very nice, tidy cache, all well set up, well placed, well hidden. Good spot, all relative to the listing, and I've just scrawled my name down in the book as a first to find, so I'm quite impressed with that. Okay, Geo Talk, just letting you know about that, and it's always interesting to come across unique, that's the word for it, it's unique. That was fantastic. Thank you, Cut Sprocket. Bye.
Thanks for that, Marcelo. And Marcelo also dropped me a call just to say that he had some tips for me for an event that I was holding back on Australia Day. And unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to be able to chat to him. But look, just a big shout out to people who are looking for some really interesting puzzle caches and well-constructed caches, because Marcelo has really set the bar quite high up in the Hunter Valley region around Newcastle. If you're after a challenge, head up that way and check out a few of his. Also, Bendigo down in central Victoria is also considered a hotspot, along with Adelaide, thanks to Zitheran and some of his clever hides. So some great constructive hides in those areas. Okay, well, it's time to head now out to the Western Plains, out to Bathurst region, and Grizz4B, who's called in.
G'day, Spin Doc. It's Grizz4B here. Just thought I'd take my new X-Trail for a spin out in the state forest and see what it can actually do, and catch a few remote caches while I'm out here. I just found a beauty out near the trig called Ovens. The cache is called Run and Jump. It's got views over the hills towards the Bathurst Plains. It's absolutely gorgeous. Just on my way back to the car now, and thought I'd drop you a line to let you know about it. What's that up in the tree?
Some big
furry thing. Let me get a little bit closer.
Oh dear, it seems as though drop bears have been the theme of this particular episode. Both Alan and Grizz4B, and along with the interview that we had a little bit earlier, seems to have featured them quite prominently. Grizz4B also wanted to write in to say that he's put out his second GeoTalk podcast into a special puzzle cache in Bathurst. Hasn't been published yet, but it'll be GC4507J. It's going to be hidden west of the Blue Mountains out in Bathurst. And it commemorates the 1815 visit of Governor Macquarie and his wife, who took a trip over the Blue Mountains to open up inland Australia. They say the rest is history. Anyway, he hopes to see me out there sometime soon. I look forward to catching up with you, hopefully not too far in the distant future. Before we go to the final call, which is actually from Noitmeister again, apologies to Giggly Gecko Gang and to Calypso 62 for missing out on their calls last episode. They both rang in with their 12-12-12 events. Unfortunately, Giggly Gecko Gang, your call sort of disappeared in the middle. I'm not too sure what happened to the phone reception. And Calypso 64, as much as you know, I'm not a big fan of events on the end of events. I would have loved to have included your bit. It was quite a laugh Just to fill you in, there was an event on the 12th of the 12th of the 12th, and about half an hour after that one was finished, there was a flash mob special geocaching Christmas sing-along outside Central Station in Sydney. Sounded like a lot of fun, and I'm sorry, guys, that I didn't get your call through. Anyway, it's the last call for this episode from Noikmeister with a milestone and another tip.
G'day, Dan. Noikmeister again. I just wanted to ring up with a milestone and a tip for the listeners out there. First, a milestone. Last year, I managed to find the most number of finds I had ever in a calendar year in all of the 3 years that I've been caching. It's pretty lucky. I didn't even know I was going for it. I was in Brisbane and saw there was a power trail called the Monster Lane series around Bramble Bay, which is near Redcliffe. And so I decided that having no bike, I'd go out and try and do it on foot. It's best done by bike. Anyway, at the end of the day, I'd done 33 plus kilometres on foot in 8 hours, and I'd found 68 caches. And when I got that was on the 30th of December. So when I got home, I did up my MyFinds stats gen and found that I'd beaten my last year's record by 8 or 9 caches. So I was pretty happy with that. So milestone and a shout out for the Monster Lane series. It's pretty good. Well maintained. There's a few missing ones, but he's already fixed up based on mine and other people's logs. Variety of hides, and most of it's along a nice area. It goes into the suburbs a bit, which I didn't enjoy as much, but I really enjoyed the more than half of it, which goes along the shoreline of Bramble Bay. And the tip. So those of you out there with Android devices might already be using GDAK, the Geocaching Droid Army Knife. And what you used to have to do with that was copy your geocaching or GSAC database onto your phone, and it would import from that. Now, I've been doing that, and there's been a few updates to it lately, and I happened to stumble across some of the new features. It is now endowed with the geocaching.com API. So even if you don't have GSAC, it makes for a very good all-round online caching app that that holds the caches on your phone, so for offline access, but from the app you can access your recently available pocket queries. You can actually just say, give me the closest 500 caches to where I'm standing right now, and you can filter that based on cache type. Once you've got the caches in your phone, you can filter all the same good things that you used to be able to do with GDAK, but the filtering on it has got even more powerful. So I think it's the only app that I'll be using on my phone from now on, GDAK. Shout out. Bye.
Well, that's all for this episode of GeoTalk. Before we go, two things. First of all, the answer to the trivia question. And the trivia question was, how many Terrain 5 geocaches are there? So it doesn't matter what difficulty they are, just the terrain. And it's an equal at the top. Victoria and the North Island of New Zealand, both at the top there with 100 caches. South Island with 92 comes in second spot. South Australia with 67. New South Wales with 66. Also on 66 is Queensland. Then Western Australia on 36. The ACT on 16. Tasmania on 13. And bringing up the rear is the Northern Territory with 10. And just before I go, a quick explanation as to why I missed out on getting the podcast out in the last 2 weeks. And why there could be a delay in any future episodes. To cut a long story short, I'm going into hospital next week to have some fairly major surgery to have it all sorted out. The good news is that the prognosis is fairly good, so it shouldn't be too long before I'm back on the caching trail and back to normal life, hopefully. But the bad news is I could be out of it for quite a while. Thank you to all my friends and family who I've spoken to already, who have passed on their best wishes. Your thoughts will help get me through, along with just wanting to continue on. Really, to everyone else, look, don't worry too much. I'll be up and about, and I'm sure that I'll keep you up to date as to what is happening. And before you know it, I'll be back on the podcast airwaves. In no time soon. Big thanks to Alan over the last couple of months and years for helping out with the podcast. I'll be in touch with him, and we'll be trying to organise something while I'm sort of taking a bit of a sojourn. In the meantime, while you're out geocaching or hiding other geocaches, just remember, safe geocaching.